This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In 1981, the CDC published a report describing a handful of patients who had a rare lung infection and a rare skin cancer. Those patients would turn out to be the first documented cases of AIDS, which actually wasn't even called AIDS in those days. The disease was officially recognized later that year, and little was known about AIDS at the time, but there was a patient zero pinpointed, the person who brought the disease into the country. Well, this week, researchers reporting in the journal Nature say that patient zero may be a medical myth. Amy Nordstrom is here to tell us that story and other selected short subjects in science. She is an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum and here with us in our CUNY studio. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ira.
All right, let's talk about what did these researchers discover about the origin of AIDS in the U.S.?
Well, what they actually did was they went back before that 1981 date when it was first recognized here in the United States. They looked for blood samples that had been collected for a different study on hepatitis B in the 1970s. They found samples in New York and San Francisco. Then they analyzed those to see if any of those patients were positive for HIV at that time. That helped them reconstruct the origins of the disease here in the U.S. and form some hypotheses about when it might have arrived. Through that analysis, they actually sequenced the full genomes of each of the viruses found in those samples, and they found out that it probably arrived in 1970, 1971, and this really flipped the patient zero story on its head. The genetics of that particular patient's HIV virus at that time did not at all lead to those later samples. It was much more just a genetically diverse virus at that time. And the patient was just one of many who had actually had the virus and contracted it.
So where did the idea that we had to have a patient zero come from?
Well, there actually is, some scientific reasons why you might try to find the very first patient or one of the first patients in an outbreak. It's scientifically useful in a lot of ways. In this particular research, they did find a CDC cluster analysis that had been done at that time, trying to track patients who had gotten HIV and trace it back through its history on a person-to-person level. That particular patient identified a lot of other people that he was sexual partners with, and that helped to sort of round out his case for potentially playing a role in the spread of the disease, but the CDC was never definitive on it, and then the myth kind of got out of control.
Yeah, it was. I remember that year and covering that story, and it was just chaos in medical community about what this was. No one knew anything about it.
It was a really scary time for all of these patients, and also I think for those researchers and physicians who were dealing with it for the first time.
Yeah. Let's move on to the. This is kind of cute. The first self-driving delivery was made this month, and of course, it was a beer delivery, right?
Right.
A beer truck, right?
Right. If you were on the road in Colorado last week, you may have been sharing it with a self-driving semi-truck. This was done by a company called Otto that's based out of San Francisco, which has been purchased by Uber. And they are branding it as sort of the first commercial delivery done by self-driving truck in the U.S. So the truck left Fort Collins, Colorado, and traveled about 120 miles to Colorado Springs. There was a driver on board. He was responsible for getting the truck onto the highway and off the highway. But once it was on the highway, he climbed in the back and read or took a nap or whatever, and the truck was able to remain in the lane, keep a safe distance from other vehicles, and make the journey all the way to Colorado Springs.
Yeah, because highway driving is the easiest kind of driving. Anybody who drives through a city traffic knows how difficult that is, but you're on the highway?
That's absolutely right. We've heard a lot about, Uber and Ford and Google and other companies trying to create cars to carry pedestrians, but that's a lot harder because you're in the middle of the cities. There's a lot of other traffic with pedestrians, and there's a lot of other obstacles to avoid. But in this case, autonomous driving might be coming to the highways long before we see it on our city streets here.
Do you have a favorite whom you think will be the first?
Ford has said they're gonna do it as early as 2021, so that's a pretty bold plan. We'll have to see. Tesla, of course, has certain versions of semi-autonomous driving right now in some of their cars that they've released.
And speaking of trucks, they're on the highways all the time, so that would make a big dent if you can get a self-driving truck.
That's right, and there's actually a big shortage of truck drivers in the U.S. right now, so this could be something that's good for the industry.
Hmm. Your final story looks at some snoozing swifts. We know what snoozing is, but what is a swift? What do you mean by that?
The common swift is a tiny little bird that broke a really big world record this year. So it is about 6 inches long, and some researchers at Lund University in Sweden, where it begins its migration, it flies all the way to Central and Western Africa each year and back, They discovered, they put some little tiny backpacks onto the back of a couple of swifts, and they tracked it and discovered that these birds stay in flight for 10 months straight. That's the longest amount of time spent constantly in the air of any bird that we know.
Let me back that up a minute. Let's yes. rewind that tape. They're in the air 10 months straight without stopping, without resting.
That's
how
right.
are they eating?
Well, they actually only eat in the air. They only eat aerial insects like moths and flies and things like that. So, you know, maybe it's kind of great to just be flying around all the time. It's a pretty energy intensive activity, but they end up, you know, doing a lot of gliding along the way on thermals. And then each night and each morning, they kind of rise up high at about 10,000 feet and start to kind of do a slow glide down. And they may be catching some snoozes in that time.
So, but they were monitored to see when they were sleeping with those little electronic backpacks on them?
Well, those were actually more to locate where they were around the world during their migration, and then also whether they were in flight or not, whether they were upright or horizontal. Other studies of actually the frigate bird have implanted brain electrodes to actually study whether that bird was sleeping in flight, and they found that birds can sleep during flight, but the common swift is too tiny to put brain electrodes and hook up the necessary instruments to measure that right now to see if they're actually sleeping in the air.
So they don't know how long the birds were sleeping. They weren't able to measure.
They don't know that, but it's likely that they're probably catching some Z's while they're coasting along.
I mean, I'm trying to think of why a bird would be flying around for months at a time.
Well, why ever land if you could? You know, why if you're tiny
well,
and
one way of,
you're shaped like a torpedo, you could just hang out up there all the time and eat insects, and maybe that's actually a great life.
How far are they from land? Are they out in the ocean? Are they flying around the continent? Or
they're
where
flying
are they?
Over land. Actually, you know, from Sweden and the UK down to like the Congo in Africa, and at night they're flying about 10,000 feet above ground, so that's
wow.
that's pretty high, yeah. So it keeps them away from plenty of other obstacles that they might otherwise run into if they are actually sleeping.
They've got to have a great oxygen system, and the air is so thin up there.
Yeah, I mean,
fly all that time.
Right. They have to be extremely energy efficient. They're very good flyers. I mean, they have a 15-inch wingspan, which is pretty big for a little 6-inch bird. And they're shaped like a torpedo, so they're amazing flyers. They're very, very efficient.
What an interesting story.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, it's okay to take a rest now. You can come down and...
That's right. Join the rest of us.
Thank you, Amy. Amy Nordstrom is associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, you've heard of wearables. You might even have one, like an Apple Watch or a Fitbit. But how about a glove that turns your fingerprints into someone else's fingerprints? Seems like I've seen this in science fiction or detective stories somewhere. Well, researchers say that the new 3D printed innovation will allow us to more accurately test and calibrate fingerprinting systems like they have at the airports or border control and so on. Sounds great, but are you like me already thinking spy versus spy? Here to talk about the good and the bad of this fingerprint glove is Ananya Bhattacharya is an editor fellow at the Quartz, a site that covers the new global economy. She joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
So tell me about the good thing about the good. What's the good thing about having this glove?
Sure. So the good thing is that you can make this one model that's going to let you have repeatable, consistent tests that you can use across various fingerprinting machines and for different vendors at different sites. So it's all the same. It's not different people trying out the same machine multiple times, because that can sort of throw the calibration off a little bit. The other thing is that you're going to have this one hand that possibly is not using actual biometric data. You could have fingerprints, but they wouldn't match up to someone else. So if it gets stolen or is used, it's not actually a problem.
So have they actually done that? Where did they get a fingerprint? How did they get it on a glove?
So the way they do it is they put it in the software on the computer. They design the fingerprints, and then they print this glove using 3D print material, which is proprietary. And the ridges actually form really well when you 3D print this. And then when you put it on a scanner, it acts just like skin, and it like splays out the way skin would, unlike using like 2D scans.
Right. Is it possible for me to take my homemade 3D printer?
No.
And make one of these gloves? Are people already thinking about that?
Yeah, no, it's not, because the researchers actually tried this with the MakerBot that comes in at around under $1,000, and it doesn't work. The printer they use actually costs $250,000.
$250,000. That's a little above most people's
yes.
budgets. But I'm going to push back on this. Not above someone who wants to do criminal activity or illegal activity or espionage or something like that.
That's true. And that's why the researchers have actually shared it with other companies and scientists because they're trying to tell them that, hey, look, if someone gets biometric data and they get this machine, they can print out your fingerprints. And what they want people to do, which doesn't yet exist, is create anti-spoofing technology. So it could tell the difference between a human hand and a fake model. And the way it would happen is that you would turn this technology off when you're calibrating the printer and use the model for consistency. And then you would turn it back on so it could tell when an actual human hand is there and only identify that.
So how far have we gotten with this? Where do we go from here with this technology?
So the researchers themselves haven't made any progress in terms of creating this anti-spoofing technology, but we definitely know that you can create these. And the other step that they're doing now is to actually 3D print an injection molded sort of case that you can then pour silicon and cheaper materials into to keep creating these hands at a lower cost rather than continuously 3D printing them.
Because you could see, I could see technology making it easier and easier, right, to make your own copy.
Right,
yeah.
So if someone gets their hand in the mold and then they pour in silicon, they could make their copy for much less than 250 grand every time. And that's why they're putting this out there to quickly start coming up with countermeasures.
So they're looking for people, the public? I mean, are they announcing this as a, let's put it out on the internet and see who can come up with some way to block this?
They're sharing it with vendors and scientists right now, not really with the public. And even if the public does know, these particular researchers also have been working on it for months and it took really long for them to even get this far. So somebody who doesn't have that base would still have trouble getting to this point.
Well, it's kind of really interesting looking glove. Thank you. Ananya Bhattacharya is an editorial fellow at Quartz. We're going to take a break, and coming up, we're going to talk about why the Internet of Things could be hurting us. Remember that cyber attack we had a week ago? We even had it affect us on Science Friday. Our chats weren't working so well. We're going to talk about how to prevent that. Plus, Alan Alda is here with his new Flame Challenge. We'll break the mystery of what this year's challenge is. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Remember last Friday, cyber attack on the DNS provider Dyn brought the internet to its knees. Major websites like the New York Times and Netflix and Twitter were down. In fact, we had trouble tweeting during this show last week because of it. We had no idea why these things weren't going through until we found out. But while the attacks did make things inconvenient for many of us, we didn't feel threatened. Our bank accounts were safe. Our private data wasn't compromised. This time, cybersecurity experts agree that this won't be the only time the internet gets hacked, of course. In fact, the next time, it could be a lot worse. And that's because the internet has been made vulnerable by us. We are responsible, more specifically, our connected devices. When your thermostat and your home security system, your baby camera, your whatever, they're all connected to the internet. And as many of these are these days, that means they are vulnerable to being hacked and being programmed to actually carry out that cyber attack. I don't know, maybe your refrigerator was involved in this sort of thing. How bad a situation have we created for ourselves? And can we unlink our devices so that they're safe from hackers, but still useful to us? Joining me to discuss the problem of the Internet of Things is my guest. Andrea Peterson is technology reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we know that the attack last Friday that virtually broke the internet was done using the Internet of Things. Explain how that happened.
So as you mentioned sort of in your lovely intro there, what happened was that somebody attacked Dyn, which is this company that provides a really key service that helps you and me and everyone else get to a lot of the websites they want to visit. It basically is kind of like a directory for the internet. It makes it so when you type in a URL, you actually end up at the website that you want to be at. But somebody decided to blast Dyn with a really astounding amount of web traffic all at once in an attack that's commonly known as a distributed denial of service attack or DDoS attack, but I'm probably not going to bring up that term again. Jargon, who needs it? But one of the most notable things about this, beyond the fact that it showed just how weak our internet infrastructure is, because you can attack this one company and take down a lot of really popular sites, was that the place that all this traffic came from was connected devices, security cameras, for instance, baby monitor, hackers, all that were controlled by this one kind of malware that's recently emerged called Mirai.
So don't these things all have passwords, you know, that people set when they use them, or did they not just change the passwords on these things?
So it's a little complicated, actually. A big problem is that a lot of devices have default passwords, and in some cases, those passwords are really hard or even impossible for everyday users to change. They can be kind of hard-coded into the device in ways that your average user just isn't going to figure out.
Mm-hmm. So are the newer devices generally less vulnerable to this type of attack then?
It depends on which devices you're talking about. Like brand name devices, I'd say yes, generally more secure. But a big problem is that we're seeing a lot of low-end manufacturers, especially in China, that continue to have a lot of security flaws. And even in the high-end devices, there are going to be security flaws that show up from time to time, but more likely they will actually be repaired eventually.
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of these cheap devices with hardwired, so to speak, passwords in them, and they're out there, and there's sort of legacy ones that are still around. As the newer ones come out that are a little more secure, these other ones are still there. And what's a person to do? I mean, does that mean we unhook our printer from the internet, or is there something we can do to protect ourselves?
Well, you can make sure your devices are behind a firewall if you have one that you haven't been able to figure out how to change the password on, and also try to change the password. If you set something up and you don't know if it had a password on it or you don't remember, try and find out. Look up the information with the manufacturer, or try some other means, Googling, to try and mm-hmm. figure out, hey, is there a better way I could be securing this device?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this time it was an annoyance more than anything else, because we didn't have anything secure that was attacked. But what would stop in the future from attacking our insulin pumps or our cars or things like that that are all connected to the internet?
So that's the fun and also scary thing. A lot of devices are showing up to be insecure. There's been some really interesting research actually on insulin pumps, where some researchers have shown ways to essentially make them kill people if they wanted to. Now, again, like, you need to have somebody who has motive and somebody who has access and the skills to do that, but it shows that there are some real world physical safety issues that come about by these little errors that are made in code.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to make the internet more secure, given that it's made to be open and accessible?
Well, and that's one of the things. The internet wasn't really designed to be secure. It's kind of this ad hoc network that we've built things on over time. And as we saw on Friday, a lot of companies don't even seem to realize that they are very dependent on this one service. And in fact, there is a way that some of the sites could have avoided that problem on Friday, which is registering with more than one company that provides the same service that Dyne provides. Now, if somebody decided to attack both of the services like that you're registered with, you're still going to have a problem, but it's a good way to back up.
Do we have an idea who did this or why? Could it have been sort of a probing of our internet services to see how vulnerable they are without actually taking them down totally?
That's a good question. Some of the research is actually pointing towards hobbyist hackers, which I think is actually almost scarier than it being like really hardcore state-sponsored hackers who are trying to take down our internet, but instead may have just been kids who were actually trying to take down a major video game network, the PlayStation Network. Because the code for this particular malware that was used was released on a popular hacker forum about a month ago. Uh-huh. And since then, pretty much anyone can actually use it to create their own network of these compromised devices to blast people with traffic.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Very informative. Andrea Peterson, technology reporter for The Washington Post. Okay, scientists, it's time to roll up your sleeves and start thinking like an 11-year-old, because it's this year's flame challenge time. And I can give you a hint. It's this year, things are Things are heating up, eh? Is that revealing too much? I hope not. With me to discuss this year's Flame Challenge question is a good friend of Science Friday, Alan Alda. You know him in his acting life, but he is also the founder of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. Welcome back. Always good to see you, Alan.
Thanks, Iris. Great to be here again.
So remind us, for those of us who don't know what the Flame Challenge is, what is it?
The Flame Challenge is a challenge I posed to scientists about 5 years ago, where I said, I didn't understand what a flame was when I was 11 years old. And I asked a teacher, what's a flame? What's going on in there? It's so interesting looking. I don't know anything else that looks like that. And she said, that's oxidation. And that's all she told me. So decades later, many decades later, I said to scientists, how about a little playful experiment? How about if you answer the question, what is a flame? But answer it so that an 11-year-old will not only understand it, but be engaged by it, be a little entertained by it. But tell the truth. Be accurate. Just be clear. Don't dumb it down. Don't be condescending. Don't leave out the essence of it. And since then, we've changed the question each year. What is color? What is time? Some really tough questions. And this year, the question we're asking scientists to make clear to 11-year-olds is, what is energy?
Whoa.
That's pretty.
That's a wide...
Yeah,
it's a wide boat.
Covers a lot of ground. So I hope that scientists, no matter what discipline they're in, because no matter what discipline you're in, energy plays a part, I would think. No matter what discipline they're in,
yeah,
they can come at it maybe primarily from their discipline and try to give a sense of what energy is in a broader way. You know what's interesting about this to me? I posed this question to scientists. I gave them this challenge, hoping it would be an interesting experience for them. Excuse me. Hoping it would be an interesting experience for them to see if they could make something complex clear to an 11-year-old. It was really for the scientists. And what I found out was there were thousands upon thousands of kids throughout the world who really enjoyed this and enjoyed learning from it. In fact, last year, one classroom said to their teacher, I wish we could learn everything this way. Isn't that? And here's what I think the clue is. A girl called Julia Handahl, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, asked the question, what is energy? And we picked up on that question. And she said this interesting thing. It's a very complicated question, but she had been a judge in last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned from the Flame Challenge that it's important to use numerous sources to really understand the question being discussed. That's so, because that's how I learn. Yeah. I really resonate with that.
Yeah.
When I'm interviewing a scientist and I hear about that scientist's work from just one direction, one they come in on one angle, I don't really get it. If they come in on two or three different angles, it kind of give me a chance to triangulate. Then I can get it. So a classroom that's judging these entries from scientists trying to explain energy, they're going to get 5 or 6 entries each classroom. They're going to discuss them, but they'll all come from different directions because it's different people, people explaining it.
And that's one of the unique things about the Flame Challenge is that it's judged by the 11-year-olds.
Yeah, that's the thing. I missed that just now. Yeah, you're right. That everybody loves that, especially the kids. You know, for a kid to be able to say to a scientist, that's a very good answer, but it could be a little better. You know, and they're very serious about the way they discuss these decisions they're going to make.
And how many kids actually do the judging? Right? And how
last year, I think we had 27,000 kids all around the world, Australia, China, India, New Zealand, Thailand, many all over the world. And we do, this is so nice to take part in. Just before the final vote, I think a day before the final vote, we do on the internet what we call a worldwide assembly. And I talk to 10 classrooms and we see them on the screen. And the kids get up to the mic, to the camera, and they discuss with one another across the world what was good about an entry, what could have been better. You know, I love to tell that story. I must have said it a couple of times here about one kid who said, you know, it's okay to be funny, but you don't have to be silly. He said, after all, we're 11. We're not 7.
No, I hadn't heard that before. We're 11. We're not 7. Don't treat us like a 7-year-old.
Yeah, it makes a big difference at that age, you know? And they're very aware of the value of humor.
Yeah.
They're very good at picking up on what makes good communication. This surprised me. They're not only talking about what's a good, what's the best entry, but what makes a good entry. You know, they would discuss it and say, oh, he gave good examples. It was good he used humor, but that kid thought the humor was silly. You know, they have real distinctions that they make that are very, very thoughtful. And it's very reassuring to hear these kids discuss these entries.
Mm-hmm. And how can scientists who want to enter this?
I hope that they eat it up.
How do they do that?
All they have to do is go to flamechallenge.org. And teachers who want to sign their classrooms can go to flamechallenge.org. And the deadline for the scientists to enter the contest is the early February, first couple of days in February. They have some time, but you remember the first entrant who didn't hear about the contest until he heard your podcast, Science Friday podcast, and he was in Austria, and he had 2 weeks before the deadline was up.
I don't know how he got that done. It's such a gorgeous.
Oh, it's a wonderful piece. He drew a cartoon. He wrote a scenario. He acted in it. He wrote a song and sang it. It was amazing in 2 weeks.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Alan Alda about his new flame challenge, which is energy.
What is energy?
What is energy? And, you know, you could say it's energy that you have to do work. You know, it could be energy from electricity. It could, as you say, it could come in so many different directions.
Yeah.
You can approach it any way you want to.
And how can you sort of tie those things together? There's two ways to do it, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists submit videos of one kind or another, short videos. And or a short statement, short written piece. And we used to say you could submit either one and one of those would win a prize. But the kids loved the video so much that we had to break it into two winning categories.
That's interesting. And if teachers want their classrooms to get involved in the judging, how do they do that?
They go to flamechallenge.org and they find out, they get an entry form and they sign up their whole class. And I hope we get lots of teachers, but I really want to get more scientists on board.
Yeah.
It's a real challenging thing to do, and it's not as easy as it appears.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, you know, like Ben Ames, our first winner, really devoted himself to it. He wound up getting well known for it around the world. He got offered a job making videos for a children's science program.
Wow.
So, I mean, it you really can go someplace with this. You can explore explaining science, explore communicating science in a fun way.
Mm. And I can't let you go without talking about your communications program at Stony Brook. Going well?
Oh, yeah, very well. It's spread. We just started an affiliation with the National University of Australia. I'm probably going to get Scotland online soon. It's all over the country. And I'm very touched by how when we see scientists or doctors or nurses learn to communicate better, to see them sometimes in a few days reach a new level that they hadn't expected to reach. It's really wonderful to see because we do this innovative thing. We teach them improvisation, which puts them in contact with the person they're trying to communicate with. That's the main reason for it, not to make them funny or anything like that. So, I'm starting a new company that will provide these services to corporations. We're working on women in business, a workshop for them. And all the money that the company makes goes to the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook.
Good for you. Let's give out the URL for the Flame Challenge again if people want to get involved.
Thank you. Flamechallenge.org. And there's also another one, the Alda Kavli Learning Center, which has wonderful information for people wanting to communicate better. So that might be fun to look at, too.
Well, next time. Alan,
thanks so much.
Thank you for all the help you've given us.
Great to see you.
Alan Alda, actor, screenwriter, you know. I'm also the founder of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University in New York. It's this year's Flame Challenge. If you don't go to Alan's site, we have it online at our website at sciencefriday.com. We'll link you right over to it. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the mundane jobs I had in college was working at the engineering school library. And what I mostly did was to Xerox articles for people. I would wrestle these big, heavy books, place them face down on the glass of the Xerox machine. It was really kind of boring, day after day, hour after hour. So I made it into a game, a sort of a challenge. If I could copy one page, flip the book over, copy the second, without the machine turning off, I would win. I didn't realize what I was doing at that time was gamifying my chore until I came across a book written by my next guest. He is a game developer. He developed a very popular competitor to Farmville. Perhaps you've played it. It's called Cow Clicker. You would think that being a gamer that he'd be into the idea of gamifying your life. But no, he says you don't need to transform things like chores and exercise into games to make them fun. The fun is trapped inside those tasks. And he's here to tell us how we can learn to play anything, which also happens to be the name of his new book. Ian Bogost is a professor of media studies at the Georgia Institute of Technology and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. His new book is Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Ian, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
Did I make a game out of that, or did I not? What was I doing there?
You were playing the copier. That's what I would say. You were playing the experience of copying.
It was.
And it's absolutely fine to call it a game, too, if you'd like to.
Mm-hmm. And so why do you not like to make things into games? Why do you think that we should not be doing that?
Well, part of the problem is this word or this trend, gamification, which you just mentioned, which suggests that, you know, games are this sort of secret world where people want to do things and they pursue them maybe obsessively. And if we could only trap that obsession and apply it to ordinary life, to sort of spread it atop ordinary life, then we would enjoy those other experiences more. But the problem with that is that the real reason that games are interesting, that they're appealing to us, isn't for those incidental features like, you know, how many points I get. I mean, nobody plays Tetris for the points. They do it for the experience of manipulating four squares that are stuck together as they fall. So, you know, when we think of games as these outcomes, then we tend not to see them as arbitrary experiences that force us to set aside the ordinary or the obvious uses of things. And it's really engaging with those actual uses of things, what something really is, that's the playful experience, whereas the gamey experience often tends to be kind of sugarcoating of something else with the sweetener of games.
Yeah, because you use Mary Poppins as being someone who was a bad example of what, a spoonful of sugar.
Right. You take something and instead of engaging it for what it is, then you spread sugar atop it metaphorically in order to make it taste better. But then once that sugar is gone, which happens very quickly, then the real true reality of whatever the task is that you're doing, that just comes right back and you're still faced with exactly the same problem you faced before.
So is the idea then to tackle the problem like just head on and to try to outthink it or plan it instead of saying I'm going to make a game out of it and try to enjoy it for what it is?
A lot of this is a process of getting out of our heads, of ceasing to be so obsessed with our feelings and what we desire, what we think we desire, and finding gratification for ourselves as the kind of primary goal or the primary purpose that we set ourselves to. And instead, when we're faced with a task or a problem or a thing or a person or whatever it is, it could be your job, it could be your commute, it could be a difficult challenge like parenting, it could be an ordinary experience like emptying the dishwasher, to focus on that thing. You know, what are its properties? What are its limitations and constraints? What can you do with it? How does it work? And how can you engage with those questions in order to produce some kind of more gratified and a deeper experience of that thing? And that's where fun comes from as well, from that kind of pursuit of depth, digging into something for what it is.
Yeah, because great challenges, you know. Let me just think of, for example, a crossword puzzle, a very hard crossword puzzle. It's fun because it's challenging. You know, when you do the Monday Times puzzle, it's too easy. You do it in 10 minutes. When you get the Saturday one, you're stuck because it's so difficult. But you enjoy the challenge of that.
We really want things to resist us. And we have the most fun when they resist us. So, you know, if you think of an activity, an ordinary one, like driving a car, and why is it more fun to drive a manual transmission vehicle? It's because you have to manipulate the device more. It's resisting you. or learning, you know, a knitting or something like that. You know, the yarn and the needles, they resist you immediately. They're not telling you what to do, and you have to learn how to manipulate them. And then over time, they kind of release these secrets. Oh, you can make a sweater, you can make a scarf, mm-hmm. you can make some socks by understanding these simple steps.
844-724-8255 is our number if you'd like to call in and talk about this new book. Ian Bogost, author of Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. You can also tweet us at SciFry. So what is the limits, the uses of boredom? I mean, we all have to do things that tedious things that we hate to do. For example, mowing the lawn. You talked about how you take mowing the lawn and turn it into something else.
Boredom is like a signal flare that when you feel boredom, it says, hey, you know, there's something here. There's something going on. You're about to find the real depth of the thing that you're engaged with because you've stopped finding all the obvious things. So, you know, that's what you experience with the photocopier.
Right. Thinking,
okay, I understand like the rote task. You know, now where does it end? How efficiently can I produce these photocopies? And I do talk in the book quite a bit about lawn care, which has become an obsession of mine after not caring about it at all. You know, it's like this task you've got to do. Oh, I got to go mow the lawn.
Right.
But once you start working with it, you know, instead of seeing it as if only I could get through this boring thing in order that I can get on to the real stuff I really want to do, then I'd be content. We tend to realize, well, you know, then the next thing, yeah, that's not quite satisfying either, and we can do that forever. So instead, that moment of boredom or feeling frustration, that's a moment where, you know, gives you pause and you can say, okay, what I really need to do is kind of dig in, learn more, and figure out how I can manipulate this object or this situation in order to get more gratification out of it. And in my case, you know, that meant learning all sorts of things about, you know, how types of grass work. And I was just working this morning on one of my lawns trying to level it out nice and even so we can put down some new sod this season. I'm very excited about this. And, you know, being out there with the ground, with the dirt, it's not that it's exciting because it's, you know, it's nature instead of the computer. It's because I'm very deliberately manipulating the material world, and I understand more about that material world as I'm manipulating it.
Yeah, because you see that as Richard Feynman used to say, I see the beauty in the things, not just on the outside, but in the inside.
Getting deeper into something. Yeah, exactly. Seeing more of its properties and kind of how it works and what it does, rather than, you know, what it does for you.
Yeah. Well, speaking of what it does for you and getting into the right frame of mind, I find that there was a little bit of mindfulness in what you're talking about. Being happy to be where you are, doing what you're doing, and taking pleasure in that.
Right. And I think that's right. I think where mindfulness stops being useful is when it returns all of that sensation or that attitude of attention back to the self. And, you know, sometimes with mindfulness advocacy, we see as a, you know, I need to be true to myself. Mm-hmm. I want to find my emotions in my center. And, you know, it implies that, well, the world is really here for me to derive pleasure from. And I need to stop and just understand what I would like to accomplish. And then I can get to the work of accomplishing it. But in fact, we're living in a time where there's just so much around us, so much information, so many things, that is bound to fail. So the initial impetus of mindfulness, of stopping and looking more carefully, I think that's very useful. And then beyond that, I suggest this term worldfulness as kind of the flip side of mindfulness. If we extend that attention back out to the world, what can I do with these things that I'm faced with, whether or not I sort of chose them, whether or not they represent my goals and my desires or compatibility with my inner sensations, that's the next stage.
And whether you're going to actually see any results from what you're doing. I know when you're on your lawn, you have a picture, you must have a picture in your mind of how much better it's going to be when you're done with it.
And part of the exercise of working with something is working with it over time, of learning something new, of understanding that the universe operates at a temporal scale that's far longer than what the human mind does. And that all these things that we're faced with, you know, they're not exactly, my lawn isn't really concerned with me, even mm-hmm. though I put it there. And so when I work with it, I have to get outside my own head and ask, well, okay, you know, how does a lawn work? And by doing that, I am able to sort of, you know, short circuit this desire to get immediate results and immediate gratification. Of course, there's so many ways to get immediate gratification these days that it's become difficult to exercise that muscle.
Interesting. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Wyoming. Toby in Wyoming. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if your guest has considered what he's been looking into in terms of addiction. I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I have found that it wasn't until I learned to be present in the moment with whatever I'm doing that I started to be able to grasp a lot of the principles of sobriety and recovery. And I think I tell a lot of newcomers that to AA that for me the simplest solution is learning to be as present as I possibly can in the moment of whatever I'm doing. So I would just look forward to his comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Toby. Ian?
I mean, I think Toby makes a great point, which is that, you know, presence implies a kind of honesty and a kind of earnestness, not just in yourself, that you're sort of saying what you mean, but that you're facing the world as it really is. You know, and facing something difficult like an addiction, I mean, this is a major thing to overcome. It requires that kind of honesty and also a humility, that there's something that's kind of inside of you as an addict that has to be overcome, but it's not fully inside of you. It's also encircling other things in the world, whatever substance or experience the addiction is swirling around. And that same attitude of being just deeply honest and deliberate about here's what I'm facing in the world, here's how it works, here's what it is, that applies to ordinary experiences and ordinary objects too.
Yeah, I know. I have a lot of – I take care of a lot of plants. I have 3 dozen plants I have to water every week, and I, you know, it's into the sink, out of the back, around, whatever, and it's tedious, but I'm trying to be mindful at the time that I'm doing that it's also making me relax. You know, it's having another effect I hadn't counted on when I started doing this.
Yeah, I mean, being in the presence of something else in the world is deeply pleasurable. It gives you the feeling that you're not alone. And we tend to think that only people or maybe pets can give us that sensation. But the truth is that almost anything can if we respect it in kind of the same way that we respect individuals, which, you know, may sound surprising or even weird to some, but it really is the way of extending that respect and embracing that humility.
Ian Bogost is author of Playing Anything, A Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits and the Uses of Boredom and the Secret of Games on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Lots of people are interested in this. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Boston. Megan Boston, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hey there.
Good. I had a question about fostering this appreciation of boredom in children who are so bombarded with video games and apps that offer this instant gratification, and it's so difficult to get them to just sit, be bored, dig in, and develop this kind of grit that you're kind of talking about. Do you have any insight on that?
Right, that's definitely true, and I would even suggest that it's not just kids. In fact, it's mostly all of us, you know, all of us adults who have this difficulty facing the world as it doesn't relate to our devices and our gadgets. And one of the things you can do is apply other kinds of limits and constraints to your life that are different from the ones that you would pursue under ordinary circumstances. So, you know, when I go outside to work on my lawn, I just leave my phone inside in the house. This seems like an obvious and simple thing to do. But it's all that's really necessary to help structure my attention toward the work that I'm going to be doing outdoors. Because if it's in my pocket, I'm just going to pick it up and look at it all the time. Kids actually have some lessons to teach us, maybe, in this regard, even though it's true that, you know, with all the devices and screens, sometimes it's hard to get them to do other things. And that's that kids tend to be very willing to pick up anything and kind of make use of it, to play it. You know, you say, okay, well, why don't you go play outside? And immediately the kids pick up a stick, or, you know, they make up a game, and who can go down the steps fastest. So that tendency among children to take things and manipulate them, but partly because they don't have the resources to buy or to produce alternatives. You know, the world isn't made for them, but one that they're reacting to. So removing those devices from kids' lives, even if just temporarily, I mean, I think that's the first step that we can take. And it's also something that, you know, doesn't have to be permanent. I mean, we are living in a technological world. We can't get away from these gadgets. We need to learn how to use them for better or worse. But I think that's a tip that anybody can learn from, not just kids and parents.
Let's go to Andrew in Danvers, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm a middle school band teacher, and, you know, one of the most frustrating things is getting kids to practice. You know, they often view it as a chore, or they view it as something they have to do. But, you know, I'm doing what I can to try to show them the joy of kind of digging deep, understanding their instrument, and kind of mastering those technical aspects, and how that facilitates better play in the repertoire that we approach. Any thoughts from your guests on how to incorporate the idea of making some of those scales and drills and things like that they start off practicing, making those enjoyable and finding the play in there?
Interesting. Good question. Ian?
I'm really glad that Andrew brought up instruments, because, of course, musical instruments are something that we play, too. And one of the great things about instruments is that they have, very limited kind of physical apparatuses that we can manipulate, the fretboards and strings of a guitar or the chambers of a brass instrument. And through that small number of physical apparatuses, we can produce a theoretically infinite patterns of sound. It's kind of magical. But one of the most important things that I think we can learn from play is that it only works, and it works best, when you apply constraints and limitations to it. So the fact that you can show your students, for example, that most pop songs are made out of the same four chords. There's actually a couple of great videos on YouTube about this. And this shows that, even if you don't know much about an instrument already, mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of possibility. There's a large possibility space for music. And then, with a particular instrument, that can be extended. What are some compositions that you can provide or that you can invite using just a single scale or a particular chord progression or maybe several different notes, and who can create their own composition with those materials, to try to show that limited knowledge that you have when you're starting out with an instrument or when you're in the kind of intermediary stage, that you don't have to wait for that to bear fruit. It can actually be immediately meaningful.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting book, Ian. Thank you for writing it. It's got some interesting thoughts in it. Ian Bogost, professor of media studies at Georgia Institute of Technology. He's a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. His new book is Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Charles Berkowitz is our director. He's our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Lou Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studio of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you will allow me a little personal aside today, a shout out to my daughter, Anna, who passed the bar today. Good. Yoo-hoo, Anna, out there. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.